On today's podcast, we are discussing a very secretive part of Lockheed Martin. Many may know it by the term Skunk Works. Some of the most truly awe-inspiring aeronautics projects known to man. And we've got just the guy to tell us about it. Someone who has worked with them, collaborated on projects, taking photography, images of many of the most top secret aircraft of all time. So buckle up for an extremely important podcast today.
Blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like an Evazine. Blast off, blast off, blast off, blast off. Come blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like an Evazine. Blast off, blast off, blast off, blast off.
Blast off on another epic episode of the Hyper Anomalous Esoteric Research Organization Podcast, aka Hero Paranormal, broadcasting from the base at La Madre Mountain, just south of Area 51. My name is Ryan, the anomalous ambassador of the airwaves, bringing you a stealthy episode today. We have none other than James C. Goodall. He is someone in the know. He's spoken to people who are behind the top secret veil, and he has been in touch with many who know what to look for when looking for things that are in the Skunk Works variety of advanced projects. When it comes to the aeronautics industry, very few have the information and intelligence knowledge as former Master Sergeant James Goodall. He is a wealth of information. I know this is going to be an absolutely amazing topic because we are talking about something that thrives on tackling seemingly impossible work, Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. Also seemingly impossible is my ability to understand why all listeners have not gone to Patreon and looked for Hero Paranormal. There is a ton of content behind the paywall. Just go to Patreon, look for Hero Paranormal, and subscribe. You can also get a ton of that content behind the paywall at Podbean via heroparanormal.com. Well, let's get to it, guys. Here it is. On today's podcast, we discuss the top secret division of Lockheed Martin. Conceived in 1943, Skunk Works, as it would be known thereafter. Super secretive, history-making engineers who worked on programs that would gather them a total of 6 Collier Trophies, the most prestigious award in aeronautics, period. And it's a tough industry. Today we speak with James Goodall, former Master Sergeant at the United States Air Force, Restoration Manager at the Museum of Air Flight, former Curator at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, former employee of the Kitt Peak National Observatory, and a man who has not only worked in cooperation with Lockheed Martin Skunk Works secret projects, but has the photographs, books, and life events to back it up. James Goodall, welcome to the Hero Paranormal Podcast.
Ryan, delighted to be here. How's your day going?
It is going great. Going a lot better now that I'm talking to you. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. You have a pretty hefty background in not only your service to this country, thank you for that, but also in photographing and witnessing, being to areas that have some of the most super secretive history-making craft that I've seen, and tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to be in these positions.
Actually, it started when I was about 5. Now, I'm a month away from being 78. So that was a long time ago. I grew up, I was in San Jose. We're not that far from San Jose Municipal Airport. It's 1951 or 52 time frame. And I'd already gone to bed. There was still light outside. My dad came into the bedroom and said, "I don't know what's coming, but you got to see it." So I got dressed and we went back outside, and all you could hear was just a deep rumbling. I mean, it was really eerie sounding. And over the Coast Mountains came not one, but two Convair B-36s. And I have, that's been imprinted in my brain since that point forward. And and it really changed everything about what my passions are, and that being machines primarily, but aviation specifically. Fast forward, now I'm about 10, 11 years old. I'm living in the heart of what is now called Silicon Valley. I was in the mountain, right on the border of Mountain View in Los Altos. And my best friend's dad was base commander at Moffett Field Naval Air Station. And we were always referred to by the Marine Securities and Shore Patrol as Captain Smith's son and that friend of his. I was that friend of his, and I was over there all the time. I mean, you know, we actually were visible to most everybody there because we were there so much. And one day I'm over there, and Danny said, "Hey, there's something in the big hangar, you know, the big hangar one there, Moffett, that you got to see it." So we headed over to the big hangar, and we just rode our bicycles right down the middle of the hangar, and people didn't even turn around and look at us because we did it so much. We get to the north end, which is the base side of the big hangar one, and there was an area that was cordoned off and said, "Keep out." There was no use of deadly force authorized or whatever, and there were no guards. So Danny, you know, pulls the curtain back, and I look at, this is the prototype XF-104 starfighter. It'd been at NASA Ames. It was at the NACA back then. It wasn't NASA yet. But they were at the big wind tunnel complex there at Moffett, you know, the Ames Research Center. And it's beautiful. I mean, the world had not seen a picture of the F-104. It was still classified. I believe at that time, it was still classified secret. And we walk around it, and here's this shiny thing. It is as beautiful of a machine as, even today, if you see a polished F-104, you'll just go, "Wow." And that was designed in the early 50s. So we're, you know, kicking the tires, looking around, and Danny says, "Get in the cockpit." So we move the boarding ladder over there, open the canopy. I get in, close the canopy, and latch it. And I'm in there about two minutes, and all of a sudden I started getting paranoid and also claustrophobic. And I tried to unlatch the canopy, and it jammed.
Oh my!
Oh, yeah. What are we gonna do now? So Danny had to go get some maintenance guys and shore patrol to get me out. Apparently, there's something was bad with the linkage from the internal handle versus the external release. They finally got me out, and we got our butts chewed. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was about 3,000. It was just hilarious. So that's where my first involvement with Skunk Works airplanes go. And then in March of 1962, I joined the Air Force. So I'm moving forward again. I'm 17 years old. I'm now stationed at Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado. I'm a communications specialist. And in late January of 1964, I get a set of TDY orders, temporary duty orders, to go from Lowry Air Force Base to Edwards Air Force Base to help support 3 programs on Category 1 testing. I did ground-based telemetry, among other things. So here I am at Edwards Air Force Base. I mean, this is going to be the focal point of the world as far as cool airplanes. And the morning of February 29th, it was a leap year, someone set up the deluge system on the flight line, And our billeting was about 8 miles from the flight line, and my vehicle was gone. Somebody had heard the alarms go off, and we all had flight line access, and it was gone. So I didn't see what happened. All I knew was something incredible came in, and it set off the deluge system in the hangar. And what it was, two YF-12s came in from Area 51. They turned, so they're, you know, the rear end is facing the entrance to the hangar, but the engines were still running before they shut them off, and the heat was so much, generated so much heat in the hangar from the engine exhaust, the deluge system was activated. And that dumps about 60,000 gallons almost instantly of water. It's going to put out any fire that's in the hangar. And about grounded the Lockheed decks, and that's what set off all the alarms. So fast forward now, where it's March 10th, 1964. It's a Tuesday. I'm taking a shuttle flight from Edwards Air Force Base to Hawthorne, California, a suburb of L.A., where Northrop had their hangar, had their headquarters. And we're going in an Italian-built Piaggio. It's a gull-wing pusher-prop type airplane. And I hear a roar, and I see debris being blown across Rogers Dry Lake. So I run down the taxiway, and I look towards the new hangar, which is near the XB-70 test pad. And I thought it was the X-15. There's this big, gigantic, monstrous black airplane. People were awful small walking around it, and the fire coming out of the rear end was just immense. And all of a sudden, they yelled, "Hey, we're loading." So I had to run back up the flight line, get in the airplane. And we took off going down the taxiway, and just took off over Rogers Dry Lake. We didn't even go out to the runway. And we banked over this thing that was on the XB-70 test pad. And I'm looking down. It already shut down the engines. And I'm looking down on it, and I cannot believe what I'm seeing. I mean, it's affected me the rest of my life. Here I'm looking down as an 18-year-old kid, looking at the world's most secret airplane, the Mach 3 interceptor version of the Blackbird, the YF-12 interceptor. And I was off the rest of the week. I had a lot of comp time. And then that following Monday morning, I got a set of orders for the Lockheed hangar. And I walked in the Lockheed hangar, and I'm looking at the back of two Blackbirds. I'm an 18-year-old kid who is nuts about airplanes. And this set my destiny. So when I got out of the service, I really wanted to get a lot of information on the Blackbirds, and I wrote the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Air Force, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Lockheed, and a few other people, asking and I'm willing to pay the going price for photos. So I wanted some air-to-air shots of the Blackbird. And their official policy back then was not to cooperate. So I had to start digging. And the more I dug, the more I found out. The more I found out, the deeper I dug. And over the course of the last 50 years, I became, from a historical point of view, not necessarily an engineering point of view, but from a historical point of view, the most knowledgeable person, probably outside of maybe two or three people, and they're probably dead now because the program goes back to the late 50s. I'm probably the most knowledgeable person from a historical point of view. I've interviewed everybody that's crashed one and survived. They crashed 20 Blackbirds. They only had 4 fatalities. And it's just a passion of mine. So I started digging. And the more I dug, the more I found out. The more I found out, the deeper I dug. So over the course of 50 years, it came to a point where literally there wasn't anything that about the Blackbirds from a historical point of view that I didn't know. So then I decided I was going to write a book on the F-117. And this time I knew what the game plan was. I knew they weren't going to cooperate, so I didn't even ask them. I just I went forward with it. And one thing led to another, and I hated term papers in high school, and I hated term papers when I was at University of Minnesota. And I said, it's not what I wanted to do. And where I'm at now, I'm trying to figure out what my 30th book is going to be. Because I have 29 books published. And you don't make any money being a writer. So don't get me wrong. I mean, literally, if you break down what I earned per hour writing my books, not counting expenses like cameras and travel and hotel and everything else that goes with being out in the field, I probably would gross, not net, but gross probably 2 or 3 cents an hour for the work I put into it. But this is a passion. This is not a job. This is something that comes from deep inside me, and it's something I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy, and I love it.
So amazing. And before we kind of get deeper into this, let's tell listeners where they can get your books and purchase them, because obviously that's something you deserve.
Thank you. If you're into the Blackbird or into the Skunk Works or into the Stealth Bomber, or even the other stealth machines that I focus on are United States nuclear-powered submarines. I have two books on first volume is on the Los Angeles class 688s and the 688Is, plus our adversaries such as the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, and Iran. And it's just I don't remember when the hell I was going. I just lost track. But it's something I'm compelled to do. I believe that I have to protect history, because I'm a historian. That's what I wanted to be when I was a young kid. When I was in high school, when I was a juvenile delinquent, so it didn't really help me any. But I wanted to be a high school history teacher. I absolutely love U.S. history and history in general. And when I was in the Pentagon at Desert Storm, I was a tech sergeant. I volunteered to go to Saudi Arabia for a year, minimum of a year, to do classified interviews from Schwarzkopf on down. But since I was so controversial, my F-117 book was out, and they felt I knew too much. They didn't want me in a foreign country with that information, especially at a time of conflict. So it's just, one thing has led into another. I have been honored to meet some of the most incredible people in the world of aviation. I met Kelly Johnson, Ben Rich, his replacement at the Skunk Works. We communicated once a quarter for 25 years. And Ben is the reason, I was able to scrounge the 8th production A-12 Blackbird for the Minnesota Air Guard Museum. And everybody was dumbfounded. I went to my boss and said, I want to get a Blackbird for our museum. He started laughing at me. And General Schwab says, well, how are you going to get it here? And I told him. And he was a little bit flabbergasted. Let me step backwards. I had 5 years active duty. I had a 10-year break. And then I wanted access to military bases to shoot airplanes, photograph airplanes. So I decided to join the Minnesota Air National Guard as a historian, and they needed one. And I spent 21 years with the Minnesota Air Guard, and that got me into a lot of places. So I'm talking to Major General Al Schwab, and I said, General Schwab, I want to get a Blackbird for the museum. He starts laughing at me. I said, sir, do me a favor. I said, what's this? He said, give me an opportunity to fail. And he said, all right, Smarty, how are you going to get it here? Because we said, we don't have money to transport it. I said, I already got that covered. He said, what do you mean you got that covered? I said, I called the Adjutant General of the State of New York, Paul Weaver, and I called his office, and the secretary answered. I said, yes, ma'am, this is Sergeant Goodall with the 133rd. That would be the 133rd Airlift Wing in Minneapolis, St. Paul International Airport. That's where it's based at. I said, is the general in? And he says, yes, sir, just a minute, I'll put you through. So she puts me through to General Weaver, and he gets on the phone, and we're chatting away, and he says, Sarge, how can I help you? I said, sir, I have a request. How would you like using one of the fives able to, my mind just went away a second. How would you like to move the world's fastest airplane in one of your C-5s? He said, he stopped, he said, you mean the Blackbird? And I said, yes, sir. He said, when you're ready, you call Will Hall. Wow. So that was taken care of. Now I have a way of getting it there. One thing led to another. We got the permission from Air Force Museum that we were getting a Blackbird. I convinced the entire Minnesota congressional delegation, at the time 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans, to sign a letter stating that there's a lot of Minnesota connection in the Blackbirds. Rosemont, for one, they do the static pitot tube and a lot of the air data stuff. Honeywell, which manufactured, built, and designed all of the electronics, the stabilization augmentation system, the autopilot, the inlet control system, a bunch of other electronics. And 3M with their adhesives and Sheldahl with their flexible circuits. So that, and 4 of the original A-12 pilots learned how to fly in the Air Guard. I got their, their wings in the Air Guard. And they were, Lou Schock, who was the first guy to fly the airplane. Jim Eastham was the first guy to fly the YF-12 Interceptor. And Bob Gilliland was the first guy to fly the the SR-71. And all three of those guys learned how to fly with the Air Guard. Bob Gilliland with the Tennessee Air Guard, Lou and Jim Eastham with the Georgia Air Guard. So there's a lot of Air Guard influence in there. And because of that, the Air Force Museum felt justified to say, okay, it's yours. How are you going to get it there? And I felt that wasn't a problem because I already had that figured out. And so we got the approval. And then in August, of course, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and that sort of put things in a jam. But we eventually got it. And in October of 2000, correction, in 1991, not 2000, over 30 years ago now, our team went to Palmdale to dismantle the 8th production Blackbird, the A-12. It's number 128. And we took the wings off at Wing Station 112. We did that in 2.5 days, but I had 3 Chief Master Sergeants, E-9s, 3 Senior Master Sergeants, E-8s, and the rest of us were either E-7s or E-6s, and it was a baker's dozen. There was 13 of us, and we just knew what to do. I mean, all these guys have been maintenance guys on Lockheed airplanes, primarily C-130s, for 30 or 40 years. So I had the best of the best as far as helping me taking the thing apart. And just one thing led to another, and we had her apart, and then we had to wait a week and a half or 2 weeks for the C-5 to be available. And they became available, and I flew back out to California. Actually, we went on our C-130 back to Palmdale, and we loaded the fuselage on its landing gear to the inside of New York Air Guard C-5A, and then second C-5, we put the engine nacelles and outer wing panels. And those two items comprised of filling up both airplanes almost completely. So it's a really, really, really big airplane. So on the 27th of October 1991, we flew from Palmdale up to Travis to get gas, spent the night there. The next morning, we take off. We're heading to Minnesota, and we're about 40 minutes out after taking off. And the loadmaster, he was a chief master sergeant. He's going to go down and check the load, make sure nothing is shifted, because we only had an inch and a half of clearance on the fore rails when we brought the airplane in, but there was about 40 chains holding it secure. So I asked the chief, I said, hey, chief, can I go down with you? As well, normally the answer would be no, but since this is, you know, this is your project, come on down. So I came on down with him, and I sort of walked around the airplane, went, you know, a good one. Then I climbed up in the landing gear, walked along the chines, and I had the canopy blocked open with wheel chock because there was no nitrogen in the counterbalance. So I opened the canopy, took the chock off, you know, put it with my between my legs, sat down. I had a bucket in, a 5-gallon bucket with a cushion in there, and I closed the canopy. So I'm in there for a good 45, 50 minutes. I mean, I'm just sitting there going to in my head, going zoom, zoom, look at me, I'm flying the Blackbird. And a few minutes later, I mean, then all of a sudden I feel a rap on the bottom of the fuselage, and I open the canopy and say, yeah, we got to go back upstairs. I said, I got to go back up, and I can't have you down by, you know, by yourself. So I went back upstairs. And now we're in our final approach into Minnesota. We just started to descent, and so we have about 30 minutes before we touch down. And the chief came back to me and said, oh, the boss said you can ride in the cockpit when we land. So in C-5, there's a behind-the-wing box, there's room for 75 troops. And forward the wing box is the flight deck. I said, well, I'm already here. He said, no, down below. So I went back down. I got in, back into the cockpit, and we landed. He landed the C-5. And when the A-12 was rolled out of the C-5, I'm still in the cockpit. And you couldn't have knocked the grin off my face with a 2x4 with nails on it. And then I called, when I, you know, finally all the dust settled the next day, I called Ben Rich. And I said, Ben, I think I hold a Blackbird record that no one will ever be able to beat. He said, what's that? I said, I'm the only person on the planet that has been in the cockpit of a Blackbird at 33,000 feet at Mach 0.72 inside another airplane. And he said he was laughing so hard, he almost wet his pants. This is per Ben Rich. He said, you know, I'm almost tempted to issue a Mach 3 minus card, but he didn't. So, and just one thing led to another. I mean, and now, you know, there was sort of the Air Force Museum didn't know what to do with the Minnesota Air Guard Museum because it was the only one under their control. And in between Christmas, in between Thanksgiving and Christmas, they sent a letter or email or whatever it was to our wing headquarters saying that the Air Force Museum has decided they were gonna take the A-12 away from us, and we had 60 days in which to protest. Well, 30 of those days were already used up. Almost 45 of those days were almost used up before anybody even read the email or the text. So they eventually took it, and that really upset the hell out of me. So it's not there anymore. But I had the honor and the privilege of being its caretaker for a decade and a half, and I'm honored for that. And then was it beginning of 2012? I contacted Lockheed and I said, would you be interested in a book covering the 75 years of the Lockheed Skunk Works, because the anniversary is coming up in 2013. And they said, yeah. And then there for a while, there was some talk about them, you know, actually funding it. But at the very last minute, I got a call from Lockheed said that, you know, even though we'd love to have it, the bean counters, you know, those are the idiots that we have to deal with, unfortunately. The bean counters said they, you know, that it wasn't in the budget. So I did it on my own, and I ended up doing my 75 years of Lockheed Skunk Works. It's 384 pages, one photo short of 1,300, about 100,000 words of text. It's hardbound, and it covers 43 programs that were created, you know, within the Lockheed Skunk Works. And there's probably 43 that I know nothing about that are so black that no one knows anything about them.
Unbelievable. So,
And so,
where's the best place for listeners to purchase that book, Jim?
The best place to get in all my books, especially if you're a Prime member, and I don't work for Amazon, or do I have any affiliation with them, but it's just a cheap way to go. If you go to Amazon.com, put in the search bar, books by James C. Goodall, G-O-O-D-A-L-L. And I know all my hardcover books will pop up immediately, but I have, like I say, I'm trying to figure out what my 30th book is going to be, and I think it's going to be Interviews at Mach 3. I have a lot of those from Blackbird Pilots.
That's awesome. Yeah. And yeah. Just for listeners, if they're not familiar with Ben Rich, he's the second director of Lockheed Skunk Works, and he was known as the father of stealth. He was responsible for leading the development of the F-117. And, you know, you've seen a lot of top secret and advanced development programs and aircraft, and Skunk Works released details recently about the craft seen. I don't know if you've seen the recent Top Gun movie, and they released some...
Twice.
Oh, that's such a great movie. Me too. I've seen it twice as well. And they released some details about Maverick's Dark Star hypersonic aircraft, because a lot of people said, come on, did you really just make this for the movie? There was a little bit of conspiracy around that they would really just make such an amazing craft for the movie. And there was an enigmatic hint in their words. Their official statement said, quote, Dark Star's capabilities could be more than mere fiction. They could be reality. And that kind of brings me to my next question. According to some insider information I've gathered, and this is not Dark Star related, but I've been told that the artificial intelligence present on the F-35 Lightning II, which is, they have them at Hill Air Force Base here in Utah, and it's possibly the most advanced fifth generation aircraft that's known about anyway. Like you said, some are so dark they're not known about. But the rumor is that the AI tech on this aircraft can distinguish not only the presence of unidentified aerial phenomena or UAPs, but can classify them as friendly, dangerous, or non-threatening. Amazing tech. So my question isn't to verify this or not, but would the possibility of that type of technology existing in our time frame surprise you?
No.
Wow.
No. You know, in 1982 or 83, I was invited by the Honeywell Avionics Group. They call it Ridgeway. Yeah, it's in the Ridgeway area of Minneapolis. And they did all the electronics for the Blackbirds, the A-12, YF-12, SR-71, and D-21. And they've been a longtime Skunk Works provider of electronics. And the head of the engineering department at Honeywell invited me because he knew what my passions were. So I'm sort of sitting in the back, and it was a banquet, and it was fun. And then the keynote speaker was Kelly Johnson. And Kelly's up there, and he said, you know, all of you know about the A-12, the YF-12, and the SR-71. And some of you are probably familiar with the little bird, which I can't talk about, but it's a toy company in San Diego. He was referring to John Andrews from Testers, who's talking about coming up with a model of their little Blackbird. And then there's some other character who lives up here in the Midwest who's written about it, and I can't even talk about it. He was referring to me.
No way.
He was referring to me. So he gets into his presentation, and he said, speed costs money. How fast do you want to go? I said, today, we have the Blackbird flying at Mach 3.2, and that's about, you can go to Mach 3.3. But anything above that, you can run into some unstarts and some other unsafe positions. He said, but we have the ability today. Again, this is 40 years ago, not last month, 40 years ago. We have the ability to build and fly a manned air-breathing platform to go Mach 4, Mach 6, Mach 8, Mach 12, Mach 16. Speed costs money. How fast do you want to go? So that tells me that, you know, that the Blackbird, even though it's the most incredible airplane to fly that we know of, it was just a piker as compared to what, you know, technology would allow us to do in, you know, in future years. Now, with the end of the Cold War, you know, the strategic enemy disappeared, sort of. And I have a dear friend, he's now retired from the Skunk Works, but he had 33 years at the Skunk Works. And he was the number three guy when he retired. They actually asked him if he wanted to be the vice president, general manager, when they instead they hired Jeff Babion. And he said, look, I'm an engineer. I'm not an administrator. I'm not a politician. So, he backed out of it. But I talk to him all the time, and I know he won't. He's the most security conscious person I've ever encountered. And then when I go to LA or whatever, I usually try to track him down and we'll have dinner. And I asked him, I said, okay, I know you can't tell me the real spooky stuff, but is there, and you know what my passions are, is there anything that you're aware of that would get me excited? And of course, it's like 6 years ago. This is before the problems with China and the problems and, you know, the bigger problems with Russia and the Middle East. He said, I have passions about the same things you do. And we have nothing in the pipeline that would get you or me excited when it comes to that level of excitement. That would be the F-117 or U-2 for the first time or the Blackbird, for example. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of disappointed. But the world has changed. Now, when they got the contract to build a Blackbird, from signing the contract to first flight was 32 months. This is 15 years after Jaeger had gone Mach 1 in a rocket-powered airplane. The Skunk Works is tasked to build the first all-titanium airframed and plastic aircraft that will fly sustained Mach 3. Because the original requirements were Mach 3 to Mach 4, 80 to 120,000 feet. So anywhere within there, if you met those criteria, you're good to go. The world has changed. So now, the last 4 or 5 years, things have gotten pretty hot, especially the last 2 years. It would not surprise me that they've had something in the works. There's about 6,000 people at the Lockheed Skunk Works production and refit and overhaul facility at Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale. So they're doing more than building replacement panels for F-22s and F-35s. And most of the place is off limits. And there's stuff going in at night. They'll turn all the runway lights off and they'll land a C-5 somewhere and everything's in the cover of darkness. And they load something in and fly it out, bring it to Area 51 for a flight test. But I doubt seriously a son of Blackbird has flown. But I asked Ben Rich years ago, I said, how come Russian or at the time Soviet aircraft like the MiG-29 or the Su-27, why do they look like an F-15 or an F-16? He said, the laws of aerodynamics and mathematics don't care what language you speak. If you're building or designing an airplane to meet a specific design requirements, whether you're building it with Russian language instructions or Chinese language instructions or whatever, or American, the design is going to be fairly similar because of if you're all building aircraft to meet the same threat, then there'll probably be a lot of similarities in how they look. So that's why the MiG-29 and the Su-27 look like Western designed airplanes.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that area in Palmdale because, I mean, it is amazing. 215,000 square feet in the California desert. I think it's on almost 600 acres. And it's kind of like, if you're into this sort of thing, it's sort of like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory with what they're doing in there.
There's a group of aviation enthusiasts, mostly guys, even though there are a few women who are into it, but it's mostly a guy thing. There's a place right on Sierra Highway, I think they call it Charlie's Corner. There was an old retired Marine. I don't know if he was a gunnery sergeant or whatever, but he was out there with his step van, and he would sell pop and whatever, but it was a gathering place for people who wanted to see incredible airplanes taking off. So during the day, you can have a U-2. Back in the day, you could have an SR-71 or an F-117 fly in and out of Air Force Plant 42. You have Sophia, that was the 747SP that was just retired. And it's just it's an incredible place. And they're doing incredible things. And everybody, all the major manufacturers, and now there's only, we only have three. We have Northrop Grumman, we have Lockheed Martin, and we have Boeing. And did I say Raytheon? Yeah, they're in there as well. So it used to be that every single manufacturer had a site. There's 10 sites at Palmdale. Site 10 is where the Lockheed Skunk Works is now called home. And I've been at Skunk Works and giving a non-classified tour of places where they can show me 6 times. And what tickles me, I had such a good rapport with everybody at the Skunk Works, is my badge. My visitor badge said no escort required. Of course, you can't get into the spooky areas unless you have a key card and know the PIN number on the cipher lock. But I just had a ball. It's just been a lot of fun. And there's stuff out there. Now, I've been to the fence line at both Area 51, this is the northern fence line, and or on top of Whitesides or Freedom Ridge, which have been taken away back in the late 90s. Or the fence line at Tonopah Test Range, about 80 different times over the last 40 years, 35 years. And I got to the point where, the security people knew me. I remember I was on the fence line with John Lear, the late John Lear. We were friends for about 45 years before he passed. And it's 11 o'clock at night. It's the middle of June, 1997. The F-117s had never returned back to Tonopah Test Range for a permanent bed down because they all moved to Holloman outside of Alamogordo. Mm-hmm. So we're about 2 miles west of the main gate to the Tonopah Test Range facility. And up there is the man camp. But from the fence line looking down to the base, it's 8 miles. And you can see the entire facility from the fence line. So we're sitting there, and you go there with your lawn chairs, and you tape up your lawn pants with duct tape so scorpions don't crawl up your leg and stuff, because they're just critters out there. And we're sitting there with our feet up in the barbed wire on our lawn chairs, just waiting for something to happen. And we both have night vision goggles on, and we notice there's three armored personnel carriers on the south side of the fence, which is restricted area. The lights off heading towards us, one from the south, one from the east, one from the west. So I stand up and yell real loud, "Hey, we're good guys, we're taxpayers." And all of a sudden we had floodlights on us, little red dots on John's chest, little red dots bouncing on my chest. And about the same time, there's a vehicle coming down the public lands. It's called BLM, but it doesn't stand for what the world thinks BLM stands for today. It's Bureau of Land Management, federal land, public land. So this pickup truck stops behind John Lear's pickup truck, and he comes around. He's in Desert Utilities. He has his hand on his Beretta. He said, "You're in a restricted area, and I'm ordering you to leave." And I said, "Sir, I don't know who you are, but this is public lands, and I don't need your permission to be here." "Yes, you do." I says, he says, "I'm ordering to leave right now." And I pulled out the aeronautical map that gives the longitude and latitude of the restricted area. And I said, "According to this official government-issued map, said we're on public lands. And if you look at the fence post over where my buddy is sitting, you'll find a USGS medallion that gives the longitude and latitude the second. I'm on public lands, and I can be here for 15 consecutive days without asking anybody's permission. I want to see some ID." I said, "Sir," and that was rude. I mean, I didn't use profanity towards him, but I used a lot of sarcasm. I know it's really upsetting him. "I want to see some ID." And I said, "Well, who are you?" "I'm Captain So-and-so with ASI," which stood for Advanced Security Inc. And I said, "Sir, you're a rent-a-cop. You don't have jurisdiction on this side of the fence." And boy, he is getting just pissed. And so "I want to see some ID." And I said, "I want to show you squat." So I've been deputized by Lincoln, Esmeralda, and Nye County to uphold the laws of the state of Nevada and the federal government. I said, "Well, good for you." And so, "But I tell you what, you show me yours, I'll show you mine." So he hands me his ASI badge, and I give it back to him. I said, "Sir, that's not a valid form of ID. I need something issued by the state or federal government." And he's getting more pissed. So he hands me his Nevada driver's license, and, you know, I don't have my reading glasses on, so, and it's dark. So I gave him my Minnesota license. Lear hands him his Nevada license. A guy comes over from the south side of the fence, from one of the armored personnel carriers, and the guy at the north side of the fence hands it to the guys. He goes back to probably the supervisor, and I don't know if you can use profanity on this, and you may want to just block it. The guy turns the interior light on the armored personnel carrier, and he said, "Oh shit, it's Goodall and Lear." The lights went off, the little red dots disappeared, but we knew they weren't going to fly anything significant that night. So I'm fairly well known out there. I've even had people I know, you know, who have been at Area 51. They said, "You know, when they took away Whitesides and Freedom Ridge from your access," they said, "all the security guys said it used to be fun. It used to be a cat and mouse thing to see what these guys are doing, you know, trying to sneak up and see what's flying out of Area 51. Now it's just boring. I'm just driving around the desert. There's nothing intriguing to do." So, and it's the world we live in today. But anybody who goes out, and I gave a presentation to the Phoenix MUFON here last spring? It's been almost a year. And, you know, basically what the title of it is "Everything You Want to Know About Area 51, But Didn't Know Who to Ask and Didn't Want to Get Shot." And one of the primary things that identified is that my mind just went blank. Mm-hmm. Oh, I hate that. Where was I? I have about 400 things going through my head at any given time. Yeah. But
well, I'll take this opportunity to ask something kind of about this recent footage that seems to be coming out of, at least apparently, from military organizations, because you've brought up something interesting that a lot of times, although these subcontractors, etc., are being hired by the military, there's something problematic that can take place. And provocatively lately, the recent media attention being paid to UAPs supposedly coming from the U.S. Navy, whether the gimbal, the GoFast, the FLIR one, the Tic Tac, and I think more recently the pyramid footage, is it possible, or is there a possibility that there are some technologies, some even in positions of power, are unaware of, such as those recent cases?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, take, for example, my favorite airplane in the world, the A-12 Blackbird. That airplane was retired for almost 20 years before they ever acknowledged the existence of it.
Jeez.
It wasn't until, I mean, they retired it in the 1968 is when they retired, you know, the last A-12.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 1988 that they even hinted that there was a secret test facility about 200 miles north of Nellis Air Force Base. And that'd be Area 51. So they're doing some stuff there. I mean, the security around Area 51 has gotten more intense since 9/11, and it's gotten more intense within the last 5 to 6 years. They've now put signage on all the dirt roads going up to where the perimeter would be of Area 51, and they don't have the authority to take that land. And I'm very tempted to push the issue, because there's a mile or 2 miles from the fence line. This is on the east side, or from the perimeter. They have signs up there. If you pass this point, you'll be arrested and your car will become, taken, and it will cause an awful lot of misery for you. And I'm looking at it, and that sign irritates the hell out of me. Where do they get off taking property that was public land and claiming it for themselves? I mean, claiming it for Area 51. That can only be done with the legislative process, something signed by the president. That hasn't been done. So we have things out there. Now, we're in a little bit short of time. I mentioned my friendship with Ben Rich. We talked quarterly for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after his retirement, I think it was 1993 or 94 time frame, he was the keynote speaker at the aeronautical school at UCLA. It was a graduate student banquet or show and tell or whatever. And Ben was the keynote speaker. And in part of his prepared text near the end of his talking about what the Skunk Works does and what they're looking for in aeronautical engineers, he said, we have today the ability, this is 1993, that's 30 years ago, we have the ability to take ET home. Now think about that statement. This is the most significant person in the aerospace industry on the planet. In 1983, we had the ability to take ET home, which means we have the ability to go fast. Fast forward to, I think he died in 97. I called Ben Rich at the at USC Medical Center. He's dying of esophageal cancer. That's from breathing the chemicals used in stealth coatings. Everybody I know that worked on stealth, they all have cancers of some sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm calling. He's he's at the hospital. We were talking about old friends and whatever, and we finally got near the end of our talk, and he said, "Jim, we have things out in the desert," and he wasn't referring to Area 51. "We have things out in the desert that's 50 years beyond what you can comprehend." Now, James C. Goodall can comprehend a hell of a lot. And he said, "If you see movies like Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort." I said, "Ben," said, you want to expand upon that?" He said, "No." And unfortunately, he passed away about 10 days later. But we're not alone. we have abilities that I think the general population or even if our enemies knew, they would say, oh goodness, we got to fear these people. But the technology is not being allowed to be released because for whatever reason, it maybe we're not in control of that information. Now for a little over 2 years, I was a docent up at Kitt Peak National Observatory, about 50 miles west of Tucson, Arizona. They have 22 optical telescopes and two radio telescopes. The radio telescopes are a 12-meter and a 25-meter. The telescopes go from 12 inch to 13 feet as far as the primary mirror. On the 2.1-meter telescope on Kitt Peak, Caltech contracted and used it remotely 4 or 5 years, and they were looking for exoplanets in our Milky Way. Now, they had a UV laser. They would shine up in the sky, and there were sensors that look, and they would, at 18,000 feet, they had to have a real specific diameter. And there's a deformable mirror on the secondary mirror that adjusts 1,200 times a second to remove any type of movement or flutter, whatever, because of air turbulences or whatever. And they said they have pretty much the same resolution as the Hubble, which is pretty incredible. And it was done remotely. But just before I left Kitt Peak, there was a gathering of all of the astronomers, the technicians, and the docents to a show and tell beer and pizza at the headquarters of the National Optical Astronomy Observatories, which is at the University of Arizona. And we had our beer and pizza, and this gentleman gets up, and I didn't know his name because I knew I was leaving. He said, I just returned from a worldwide conference on exoplanets, and this is everybody. I mean, regardless of whether any astronomer looking for exoplanets was at this conference. And said, based on proven mathematical formulas that we've used, developing what's out there, we calculate based on all the new information from exoplanet research that for every star in the universe, there's 1.5 planets. And think about that number. I mean, you can't even put just the decimal points down. It would probably fill your house if there were an object. He said, out of that incredible number of planets, we calculate, again, using proven mathematical formulas, that there are 2 billion, and that's with a B, 2 billion Earth-like planets orbiting a similar-sized brown dwarf star as our sun in the inhabitable zone with liquid water. And to quote Jodie Foster's character in the movie Contact, if we're the only ones, what a waste of space. So it is pretty incredible.
It's unbelievable.
We're not alone. We're not alone.
Yeah, I think
most of the Apollo moon astronauts, guys who landed on, most of them that have spoken, regardless of what the consequences are, have all said, we were being observed on the moon by aliens. I mean, it's documented. And that's pretty wild. Yet, and apparently they have photography of structures on the moon, primarily on the backside. Mm.
Yeah, I know when I spoke with John Lear, he had mentioned some of these structures on the backside. So there is some truth to that.
Apparently, yeah. Yeah. And why did we quit going to the moon after Apollo 17? Maybe we were told by powers that are more powerful than we are, it's not a good idea to come here. Don't come here again for a while. Mm. And now we're allegedly heading back. So it's gonna be interesting. I can hardly wait for the moon landing.
It's wild when you start to fathom what our technology might be like now, because as you mentioned, I mean, the Blackbirds top speed was officially Mach 3.2, but I've been told that it could go much faster than that, and it was able to outrun missiles. And I mean, this is older technology.
Yeah, I mean, it could outrun the early SA-2 SAMs, the new ones, the new Russian ones. No, probably could take it down. But in the environment that it flies in, is less than a tenth of a percent of the atmosphere up there. I mean, you're 0.4%. Excuse me. So half a percent of the atmosphere is up there. So overpressure can't damage the airplane. That's how they took down Gary Powers in the U-2. They didn't hit him with the surface-to-air missile or air-to-air missile, whichever it was. But when it exploded, the overpressure destroyed the control surfaces. At 85,000 feet, you have to hit the airplane. And when Kelly's team designed the Blackbird, they designed it that if any major composite panel were to be lost, the airplane is still fully functional and able to get home. So that's never happened. I mean, they tried to shoot it down and they couldn't.
So amazing to think where technology is today and where it will be tomorrow. Your stories and knowledge base are exponentially more than the usual guests I've had the opportunity to talk to, Jim. And I thank you so much.
Anytime. If you want me to chat with me again down the road, I'm more than happy.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. And thanks so much. It's been an honor. Can you tell listeners where they can keep up with your work, beautiful photography, books, and more?
Well, again, I don't, the only thing I have is Facebook. So if you Jim Goodall on Facebook, and usually if it's someone who's a real aviation enthusiast and he doesn't know anybody else, I don't really discriminate when people want. Oh, can I be on your friends list? Sure. Who am I to say no? So, I gotta run. I gotta be on another program here right now.
Okay. So. Thanks so much, Jim. Have a wonderful one. It's been an honor. Thank you, sir.
You take care. All right. Bye bye.
What a treat, man! Oh man. You know, Lockheed Martin and Skunk Works in particular has been tackling seemingly impossible work, impossible tasks, and guaranteeing impossible missions, developing technologies for tomorrow's challenges, oftentimes before the need is even identified. They've created stealth capabilities, radar evading aircraft, X-planes, and revolutionary technologies in between. They have a long history and tradition of quickly developing things, sometimes under the cover of darkness, under circus tents, with enduring innovation when it's needed most. And it was such a blessing to talk to Mr. James Goodall. He's definitely somebody who knows what he's talking about and has talked to those in the know. Speaking of those in the know that there is a ton of content behind the paywall at Hero Paranormal on Patreon. Go to Patreon, search for Hero Paranormal, and subscribe. You can also access a bunch of the content behind the paywall at Podbean via heroparanormal.com. Until next time, keep your eyes to the skies, feet on the ground, but don't forget to take a look around.
Come blast off in my time machine, third eye feeling like an Evazine. Blast off, blast off. Blast off, blast off. Come blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like an Evazine. Blast off, blast off, blast off.